This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Anthony Brooks and Meghna Chakrabarty. Today in Washington, President Obama opened the White House Conference on Mental Health, calling for a more open conversation across the nation.
We whisper about mental health issues and avoid asking too many questions. And the brain's a body part, too. We just know less about it.
The president also specifically mentioned children.
Even though three-quarters of mental illnesses emerge by the age of 24, only about half of children with mental health problems receive treatment. Now think about it. We wouldn't accept it if only 40% of Americans with cancers got treatment. We wouldn't accept it if only half of young people with diabetes got help. Why should we accept it when it comes to mental health?
Here in Massachusetts, children's mental health care was in the news this month when Cambridge Health Alliance announced plans to shrink its acute mental health services for children and teens. The plan was to consolidate Cambridge Hospital's Child Assessment Unit and Adolescent Assessment Unit, effectively eliminating 11 beds. A passionate response prompted lawmakers to promise some potential short-term funding, so Cambridge Hospital withdrew its plan. But is that just a Band-Aid? And what is really facing children and their parents when it comes to mental health services in Massachusetts? Joining me now for more is someone who's been there. Lisa Lambert is Executive Director of the Parent Professional Advocacy League, which advocates for parents who have a child struggling with mental illness. Welcome to Radio Boston, Lisa.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about Cambridge Health Alliance and this development of Cambridge Health Alliance withdrawing its plan that would have eliminated beds. Is this a victory for parents, do you think?
It's a temporary victory. It's a victory over the next so many months, but the imminent risk of other units closing is always on the horizon.
And you became an advocate for parents because of your own experience.
I did. My own son, who's a young adult now, when he was in first grade, began to have a lot of issues. And by the time he was just turning 7, was so depressed that he tried to kill himself and had his first hospitalization, which catapulted me into a world I didn't know before.
Right. And has it gotten better since then?
It has. It does take a great deal of effort on the part of the parent to make sure that you get the services you need and find the professionals that can help you.
And are there enough beds?
Well, it depends on what time of the year you ask that question. If you ask that question in August, there are plenty of beds. If you ask that question in May, there aren't enough.
Okay, so it's a seasonal issue.
It definitely is.
And the science bears that out, that we know that in the fall and later until the spring that there is a more acute need for child psychiatric beds than...
Yes.
Huh, interesting. Well, listeners, we want to hear your stories as well. Are you a parent who has sought mental health treatment for your child? What was the experience like? Or what about the idea of hospitalizing kids? Is there a better form of treatment? We want to hear your stories and know your thoughts. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can find us on Twitter and Radio Boston at Radio Boston. Well, Lisa, we're going to add two more voices to this conversation. Dr. Susan Swick, she's Chief of Child Psychiatry at Newton Wellesley Hospital. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me and for having this important conversation.
You're welcome. Also with us is David Mattiotto. He's Executive Director of the Massachusetts Association of Behavioral Health Systems. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Swick, I'd like to talk with you first. Take us into your emergency room. And for folks who don't know, what happens when a child goes in seeking acute mental health treatment?
So it's a great question. And Newton Wellesley Hospital is a community teaching hospital. Our pediatric emergency room is relatively busy, has about 16,000 visits a year. And about 3% of those are mental health visits, primarily psychiatric visits. Doesn't sound like a lot. It's about 480 this past year, which was already about a 15% increase from the year before. And that's been steady. It's been going up about 15% a year, the number of child psychiatric visits. And it's outpacing the increase in overall medical visits. So when a child comes into the emergency room with a psychiatric problem, clearly, it's a crisis. Usually, whenever there's a concern about a child feeling depressed, a child struggling in school, other symptoms that would make a parent concerned, they go to their pediatrician. They'll speak with a guidance counselor at school. They're going to take advantage of other resources they have in the community. But because we have, I think, contracting and limited resources in the community, a lot of children aren't getting the care that they need as outpatients. So I was delighted. I'm delighted to hear President Obama talking about this. And my mind goes back to almost 13 years ago when the Surgeon General David Satcher also talked about this and did his report on children's mental health care and had a national call to action. And it feels as though all of the great ideas and plans haven't quite been realized since then. And I would suggest that President Obama's numbers are a little bit better than the numbers I've been hearing, which is that almost 80% of children who present with psychiatric problems get no treatment from a psychiatrist. So maybe he gets to 50% because that 30% difference, those kids are getting care from pediatricians, from counselors or psychologists through their schools. There are other resources to get care and support that often can be very effective, but there just isn't access to care. Mm. So they end up coming to the emergency room in a crisis.
And so, yeah, so it's a crisis situation. They go into the emergency room where everyone's being treated. All medical issues are being treated.
Yep.
And is there a specialized team in the ER? And,
yep.
And then what?
So what happens is they'll start with a triage nurse who sees everybody who comes to the emergency room, who will suss out that this is a psychiatric problem primarily. They're sent to, there's special beds that are in a quieter part of the emergency room for these kids. Their parents are allowed to stay with them. If there's concern about safety, they'll have a one-to-one who is a specialized aide that can sit there just to ensure that the child is safe while they're in the emergency room. And then they call social work to alert them that there's a child psychiatric case presenting, because we've learned that it's hard to find beds for these kids if they're going to need a bed. So we begin the process as quickly as we can. And then they consult the psychiatric consulting team. We're one of the few community hospitals in the state that has child psychiatrists working in our consulting team. So, you know, 5 days out of the week, we'll have a child psychiatrist who can come down to the emergency room and evaluate this child, speak with parents, talk on the phone with a pediatrician or with the school counselor, and try to build a richer story about what happened and what's going to be the least restrictive setting in which we might be able to begin treatment for this child.
Mm-hmm. So Cambridge Health Alliance, in its plan to eliminate some of these beds, said that there was less demand.
Mm. Well, which seems amazing to me, but I do agree that there is periodicity in the demand. And science bears this out epidemiologically. So observationally, kids and adults with psychiatric problems are much more likely to have exacerbations in the spring and in the fall. It's not just because
which is what Lisa mentioned at the beginning
it's
here.
It's very true. We're not sure why. It's not just seasonal affective disorder. It's not just finals or starting school again, because it happens regardless of whether they're in or out of school. But it's a very common, predictable phenomenon. So in the spring or in the fall, there's often a dramatic shortage of beds. It is not uncommon in the spring to hear about children being stuck in the emergency room, our emergency room, but also those throughout the greater Boston area, for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 5 days. And, you know, you have some horror stories on the long end. But it's easy to say that the mean length of stay in the emergency room for a psychiatric patient is twice as long as that for a child who doesn't have a psychiatric problem, who's in the ER just for a medical visit.
Hmm. And if that child, are there studies that show that if that child needed to get a hospital bed for a physical issue, is there a difference?
Yep, it's much quicker.
It's much quicker. We definitely know that. So I want to bring in David Mattiotto, who's with the Massachusetts Association of Behavioral Health Systems. David, we've heard that Cambridge Health Alliance, when it was thinking about closing or consolidating some of its beds, that there are huge funding concerns, and it cited public insurers in particular in its plan to consolidate some of the beds. What's the funding situation like, and why single out public insurers?
For the average inpatient unit in Massachusetts, it's about 60% public payer, which is either MassHealth or one of their MCEs, managed care organizations. And the rates for the public payers through MassHealth are about 25% below what the private sector rates are, which, you know, arguably are low to begin with. So there's a real funding issue from Medicaid and MassHealth. The other point there is the hospitals have only seen one general rate increase in the last 5 years from MassHealth.
Mm-hmm. So when you say 60%, that means that you're only getting 60% of the total cost from the insurer, pretty much, and the hospitals are picking up the other 40%.
No, the other 40% is private insurers. So the inpatient sector for child behavioral health is pretty heavily dependent on the public insurers.
I see.
It's dominated by the public insurers.
Mm-hmm. But the reimbursement rate is not even
not sufficient.
Close.
No, it's about 25% below what the private sector pays.
I see. Now, we should remind listeners that we have what's known as Rosie D. here mm-hmm. in Massachusetts, and that was the lawsuit that against the state over appropriate mental health care for children on public health plans. I'm wondering how this can happen in a state like Massachusetts when we have that requirement for state-subsidized health care for children to be appropriate, especially for mental health care.
Well, part of the problem is we have a lot of kids. We have about 250 licensed beds for child and adolescent inpatient care in Massachusetts. That's all, about 250. And on a given day, there's anywhere from 60 to 80 kids who are on these units who could be placed elsewhere, except for there's nowhere for them to go. A lot of these children are state clients, and we work very hard with the state to move them to residential and community settings, but the waits can often be quite long. And that adds to the backup because the children in the emergency room therefore have to wait because often beds are taken up by children who could be in another setting.
So essentially what you're saying is there aren't enough community-based programs to send them to, so they have to stay in the acute care facilities, which then leads to the backup in the ER, so it's a domino effect all the way down.
Correct.
Okay. And is that your experience, Susan? Do you think so as well? Yes.
Yes, I would agree. And I think the key, you know, one of the things we in mental health try to think about a lot is this least restrictive setting idea. And for kids in particular, the idea of trying to have them in a place where they can have outside time, they could have time with their parents, where we're doing interventions with the family that are going to support managing their illness, stabilizing the crisis, and actually trying to promote health, mental health, that's often the key. But there really is a paucity of excellent community-based programs where we can provide for the sicker among our children.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, your take on that.
Well, one of the things that comes to mind for me is that I remember when I once had a cat who was very ill, my vet said to me, you shouldn't be running a cat hospital at home. And we don't think that a parent who has a child who's at risk to themselves and their brothers and their sisters and everyone else in the family, the parent should not, on top of being a parent and trying to be their therapist, should be running a hospital at home either. And one of the things we're most concerned about is the burden on families when these backups occur and when there isn't a service that's available to them. If I could, I'd just like to tell you two quick stories of families that have contacted us. It brings it alive when you understand what these waits are like. About 3 days ago, I was emailed by a mom who had a seven-year-old. She's in the south of Boston area. Mm. They waited 12 days for this little boy to get into a psychiatric bed.
In the ER.
In the ER. Mm-hmm. And it took, the place that he finally went was an hour and 40 minutes from her house. She has other children at home. So how this mother is going to go an hour and 40 minutes each way to see him while he's there and then try to prepare what he needs at home is beyond me. I mean, she'll do it, but it certainly will be, you know, one of those things where she's trying to figure it out as she goes along. And another story that particularly got me this year was a mother who had a child in the greater Boston suburbs, and the mother had cancer, and they waited for 6 days in the emergency room until the mother's medical needs were so severe that she had to take her daughter, who wasn't in a bed, and bring her home because she herself needed treatment. Mm. So the personal cost to the family is very high. And while we talk about rates, and it's really important, I really want to emphasize that that's part of the equation as well.
You mean the reimbursement rates? And
the reimbursement rates, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we have our phone lines completely lit up here with folks who'd like to join in the conversation a little bit. So who we'd like to go to first is Anna, who is calling from Brookline. Anna, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. I wanted to share my experience, which was 3 years ago. My son came forward and had suffered almost a year of sexual abuse and was having PTSD and depression, was admitted at Franciscan Hospital for Children after a long wait. And so we were completely confounded and confused by the whole system. We felt completely alone and isolated and were really sort of scrambling to find a place for him. We have lots of other kids at home. And the other sort of second issue was that when he was finally admitted, he was obviously a victim of abuse, but was with kids who had been perpetrators. Hmm. And so there's so few beds that I think all of the kids with, you know, myriad issues are all grouped together. Hmm. And so our only choice was to sort of intensify our visits and making it 2 and 3 times a day to make sure that he wasn't further suffering. And they were very careful, but the triggers that were there were also really hard, and it made his almost 2 month stay, you know, very difficult.
Mm-hmm. And how old is your son now? And how old, you said it was 3 years ago?
Yeah, he is now 12.
Okay, so he was 9. And how's he doing?
And it's a long road. Mm-hmm. It's a very long road. Mm-hmm. He's doing much better. He's transitioned from a special needs school back to public school, but you know, certainly his life and our entire family's, you know, has been completely altered, and the trickle down effect to siblings, you know, is just enormous. But I feel like, you know, if I had $1,000,000,000, I would start some sort of public sort of information center where parents could go, because I felt like we were just searching online and we're fairly informed, lucky people, and still it was just hellacious.
Okay, mm-hmm. Anna, thanks very much for your call. Lisa, let's talk about that for a moment. I mean, is Anna's story typical?
We hear a lot of stories very similar to hers, and sometimes the grouping of kids is maybe there is one who's 12 and one who's 6, and you don't necessarily feel that that's a good match. Or, you know, there's a variety of things that doesn't always work. When the staff is wonderful or when it's adequately staffed, it can, as she said, be managed very well. And when the unit is very welcoming of having the families on board, that also makes a huge amount of difference.
David Mattiotto, I want to go back to the Cambridge Health Alliance plan, which is sort of the basis of this conversation in a way, but it brings up, of course, all of these other issues. And in part of their plan, they wanted to consolidate the child assessment unit and the adolescent assessment unit. And what that would have done essentially was increase the age at which they would start treating children to age 8. I'm wondering, do we see a lot of demand for care for kids before age 8?
Again, it depends on the time of year. Unfortunately, with the child mental health, it's in some ways very predictable, but it's also in many ways very erratic. And as Lisa had said earlier, during the summer, we may have 14-bed units with only one or two kids on them. And that can be very hard financially for the hospital's long-term solvency. We do see that at times there really is a crunch, and there are only 45 beds in the whole state for kids, young children under 8. And so it can really be a crunch at certain times, and that's part of the issues that we're all trying to deal with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So do you think that there is less demand then overall for these beds when you look at it? I know it depends on the time of year, but maybe if you look at it in a yearly average, I mean, how do you make such a determination?
Well, I do think since CBHI, which was the Rosie
Children's
D case,
Behavioral that, yes, Health Initiative.
There's been tens of millions of dollars put into the community behavioral health system, and I do think that's had some impact on the demand. We've seen the beds go down by about 20% from 310 5 years ago to about 250 now. But it seems that we've, in my opinion, kind of plateaued, and to go much lower would be very difficult. But our big issue from the hospital standpoint is how do we maintain these units 12 months of the year with the financial pressures and the variability in census. So it's a real problem, and we're hoping that the state and the insurers and the consumers and the hospitals all come together and try to figure out some solutions.
And Susan, what would you say to that?
Yeah, I would very much agree. And I was really thinking about the fact that, you know, well, the youngest children need hospitalization quite rarely. But when it does happen, it happens 100% to that child and that family. It's hard to find those beds. It's a very good predictor in our emergency room of length of stay if the child is younger than 7 or if they have a major developmental disorder, so sort of autism spectrum disorder. It's going to be very hard to find them a bed. Thinking about making it financially sustainable is incredibly challenging and out of my wheelhouse, although I've started learning to think about these things also. But clinically, I often then turn to think about what are all the other levels of care we could be cultivating so that we minimize the times that we actually need an inpatient stay. And for the youngest kids, often those inpatient stays could be brief if we have excellent community-based health care. One of the other things your caller just mentioned was about how parents can be so bewildered by the system of care. And one of the best predictors of a child's outcome is going to be how well their parent is coping with their diagnosis. And you think about even if a child has tremendous treaters that they're seeing twice a week, they're still spending the vast majority of their time at home. So if their parents feel supported and get good education and guidance, not just about how to manage their child's symptoms, but also to manage the healthcare system that they've been thrown into, that child is going to do a lot better. So I like to put my attention on that as well as on how are we doing at all levels of care, inpatient as well as outpatient.
I'd like to take another call. Angie is calling from Medford. She's a school psychologist. Angie, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me. I have two main points. The first is just that working in schools is incredibly frustrating, especially around the mental health issue, because the demand being placed on schools to provide for kids for mental health needs is increasing all the time. We feel that there's a lot of pressure put on us to treat the kids in school, which is not really meant to be what our role is, not to be therapists, but to be providing support for kids with concerns related mostly to their functioning in school, and yet we're being asked to be family therapists and broader kinds of things like that. And it's not just school psychologists, it's schools in general just don't have the support that we need to be able to provide families with support. Mm-hmm. And the second thing I wanted to mention is, and I don't want to minimize in any way the pain and the difficulty that parents often go through with these concerns, but on our end, I know that there are many times where we have a hard time sort of convincing parents of the severity of what we're trying to tell them. We see a concern come up. I work at a higher age level, so I often deal with students who are presenting with suicidal ideation, and trying to convince parents that it's something that they really have to take seriously can be very challenging, and I know a lot of that comes from parents' fear that having me say this to them about their child must be terrifying. But basically, going along with what your one speaker had said, that the parent's ability to be able to manage the child's mental health concerns is very, very important in their long-term care. And we oftentimes have to be sort of the first educators for parents that they need to be there. They need to not ignore this concern and not push it aside as though that's just typical adolescent angst. Because I don't consider myself to be an alarmist, so I wouldn't call a parent if I didn't think that the concern was real.
Right. So schools are struggling as well as to how we deal with the whole new landscape and stigma that we still have about mental health and education. And, you know, if Dr. Swick is telling us that you're seeing a 15% increase in children coming into the ER with mental health visits and schools are seeing an increase, how do we deal with it? Angie, thanks very much for your call. Lisa, what I'd like to ask you is, why don't we have stronger community-based programs? If we're required to, and it seems like they're desperately needed, what's the holdup?
We do have good community-based programs in many communities. They aren't as targeted, or people aren't trained as much with a focus on very young children. So there's a gap right there. But also for kids who have private insurance, the Blue Cross, Blue Shields, Tufts, Harvard Pilgrim, there are no such programs. And they're out in the desert trying to figure out what to do by themselves.
So publicly insured kids have more access
to
the community.
Yes, they certainly do.
Programs. Well, we could go on and on for many programs, but we have to end right now. I'd like to thank all of you for being with us. David Mattiato, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Association of Behavioral Health Systems.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Also, Dr. Susan Swick, Chief of Child Psychiatry at Newton-Wellesley Hospital. Thank you.
Thanks for starting this conversation.
And Lisa Lambert, Executive Director of the Parent Professional Advocacy League.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Listeners, keep this conversation going online at radioboston.org or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/radioboston. Stay with us. Coming up, Boston's Huntington Theater Company gets a Tony this weekend. We'll take a look back at some of the theater's winning performances. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.